We have now got a conception of what is the divine Shakti. It is, as we have seen, a timeless power of the divine working in terms of time, spread over all the levels of the universe of which we are a part, working to produce results on the universal scale as also on the individual. We perceive it from our level of intelligence as a universal energy, an energy that takes appropriate forms on different levels. We see it working as physical energy, also as a tremendous life energy, and as an energy flowing in terms of thought, in forms of thought, at the mental level. Everywhere, it is the massive aspect, unlimited nature of the power, of the energy that we are confronted with. And yet, individually, most of us feel that the energy which is real to us is only a limited energy. We know only that much energy, physical, vital or mental, as is embodied in us. That quantum over which we have control, which follows our will. Actually, Sri Aurobindo points out that it is what we are conscious or what we think to be our individual will, individual energies, they are not our own. They are only small inlets from the universal ocean of energies. But we feel them limited. We feel a certain constriction around them. And we are unable to feel their universal character in the action of the energies that act in our system, because our ego comes forward and claims certain areas of the action of energy only as its own, parks off the rest as not its own, as something belonging to others. This arbitrary division by the ego between myself and others is what strikes at the root of experiencing the universal character of the energies. This is so only at the lower levels of the working of the energies. It is possible by discipline, by keeping the larger vision before us, and by a sustained effort at expansion, at extension of ourselves, it is possible step by step to arrive at an identity with the universal energies. This is what is called at the level of energies universalization. Even when our energies are fused with the universal energies as a result of this process of self-enlargement, we should note that the stamp, the overall stamp on these universal energies continues to be of the inferior nature, consisting of the three modes, the gunas, sattva, rajas and tamas. Only the perspective is broader, the field is larger, but the character by and large continues to be the same. It is possible, however, to break out of this bond of inferior nature by becoming conscious not only of the universal force, the universal prakriti, but also the fact that this prakriti is what it is. Prakriti exists because there is a person, there is a purusha behind it. And the seeker gradually shifts his attention, his gaze from prakriti to what sustains the prakriti, the purusha, the divine being, the one person who sustains the myriad currents of the universal energy. As one mentally understands and psychologically and spiritually takes one's poise in the status of the purusha, gradually there is a certain detachment, an aloofness from the action of the gunas, the modes of inferior nature. This detachment, this aloofness gradually develops into a movement which leads towards the mastery of the lower nature. As one gets progressively released from the compulsive hold of lower nature and develops in the higher nature, one realizes that the purusha and the prakriti are not really two different things, but are one and the same. The prakriti is the purusha himself in his aspect of power, in his aspect of executive energy. And the identification with the purusha extends itself to the truth behind the prakriti. Nature and being, the Lord and his puissance, one approaches an identity with both. But the process is long, and the first step in this process is for the ego, for the individual acting in terms of the ego, to surrender himself to the Shakti which is acting. And the action of this power, higher power, in the very nature of things cannot be continuous at the same level of vibration and intensity. Its force, its action is felt intermittently. There are ups and downs, days and nights, when one feels consciously the action of the Shakti, and there are times when one only sees the results but is not conscious of the working. A link has to be established between our mind and the spiritual consciousness and the spiritual heights as one develops spiritually, which enables this action to become gradually continuous without a decisive break at any time. How to surrender? Surrender is a word. The practice leading to the fulfillment of surrender is yoga. And the first step is for the individual worker to give up the sense of the doer, the ego claim to be the instrument. One should move beyond the position of being an instrument. The doer also, not only the impeller, but even the doer, it is the Shakti. That is the realization which must be acquired. Once one loses this ego appropriation of the sense of doer, of being the instrument, one gradually opens to the workings of the higher power. Stationed in that working, one has to cultivate and practice in moment to moment what Sri Aurobindo calls the Gita ideal of samatha, equanimity, equality. If I am not the doer, if I don't have my eye on the fruit or the result, if it is something else that moves me, something else that works through me, I had better leave the results also to that power which moves and works. So whatever the result, there is not the longing for a particular result, there is not the straining towards the fruit. It is left to the Shakti, to the power, and there is a resultant, tranquil sense of equanimity. Whatever the result, as this samatha, as this equanimity deepens, gradually there is an awakening to the presence of the Self. The Self, not only at the individual level, but at the universal level. The Self behind the universal Shakti, one opens. And the experience of becoming one, for however short a time, with this Self, is total non-involvement, a total detachment. But the interest continues. One continues to witness. One continues to follow what is going on, but without any claim, without claim for the action going on or over the results that are to ensue. And this realization of unity with the Self also is not the final step. In certain yogas, it indeed is, but in the integral path, the realization of the Self is only a door opening to a larger and more consequent realization, the surrender to the master of the being. And the master is the same, the master of the universe and the master of ourselves is the same divine person. Thus, there are, as we look round, there are three powers of the divine. One is the individual, the jiva, the evolving soul. Second, God, the reality manifest as the ruling power not something impersonal, not an impersonal state, but someone, some person who can be approached, with whom one can enter into relations. As I said in one of our talks, one can't enter into relation with an impersonal state like silence or nirvana or peace or even ananda. One can only enter into a relation with an individualization, with a self-formation which lends itself consciously to conscious experience, and that is God. The reality turned towards manifestation, taking a form which can, though it cannot be understood, which can be realized, which can be identified with, which lends itself for conscious relations, that is God. And the third term is nature. Nature is the universal power taking myriad forms, coursing through many movements, and linking in a way the individual, the jiva and the God. What is the relation of the jiva, the individual, to God and nature? The first relation one realizes is that one is a portion of God, what is called in the Gita an eternal portion of himself. He shares the eternity of the parent being. One is a portion, one is a parcel of the divine being. One also has a relation with nature. Not nature as we understood, the physical nature, but nature in all its grades, which as we have seen is a self-formulation of the divine being. The higher nature, the spiritual nature, of which the physical nature we are familiar with is only an outer mode, of that nature the individual realizes himself to be a product. He has been formed by this nature out of the being of God. So Sri Aurobindo quotes the two famous sentences, formulas: I am God, soham, he am I. And to express the relation with nature, the supreme nature has become the jiva, para prakritir jiva bhuta. These are the two spiritual formulas which enshrine the experience that an individual realizes both with God and with nature. Then what stands between our knowledge that this is so and our experience in day-to-day life? We behave as if we are separate from others, we are separate from God, that we guard ourselves from nature, nature is something different. That, as we said, it is due to the intervention of the claims of the ego. Ego compartmentalizes, ego fragments, ego cuts asunder what God has made one. Then why is ego allowed to do it? That is because it was a necessity in the process of natural evolution to give a certain fixity to the flux of the life movements, to centralize the vague movements of mental and life energies. An ego point was constructed by nature. around which all the movements are organized. But with the arrival at the stage of self-awareness in man, the time has certainly come for this ad hoc arrangement to give place to a more natural arrangement. The ego has served its purpose, and the ego should dissolve itself or should be dissolved by our will, so that the true center, the true point of centralization, the inner psychic being or the soul, may come forward and occupy its place, which today is occupied by the pseudo-self or the pseudo-soul, the desire soul, the ego. And the ego has to be taught to surrender itself and to identify itself. Of course, in the process of identification, the ego tends to evaporate, and that is just as well. There are certain dangers, however, in identifying ourselves or in opening ourselves to the universal workings of the Shakti without the proper knowledge, without the proper balance, without, in a word, having the spiritual discrimination and common sense. The first danger, and usually a very common danger, is the ego tends to exploit the Shakti. It wants the Shakti to flow in. It opens all the doors of the being for the inpouring and the action of the universal Shakti. But once the things start, the ego starts subtle claims and exploits the mighty workings of the Shakti for its own purposes, self-aggrandizement, fame, constituting itself as the lord of the limited empire, and so on. So this exploitation of the Shakti by the ego, or claiming to be an instrument of God, but in effect, in practice, turning God into its instrument, this is also a danger to which Sri Aurobindo had repeatedly drawn attention. He wrote so many letters pointing out to sadhaks here how, instead of surrendering and becoming instruments of the mother's force, they had been using the mother's force for their own personal ends. This is a very common danger. And the ego always has very specious explanations, and it puts suggestions which catch us unawares. We should know that always we are but puny creatures. It is only the mighty force, that impulsion from God, that moves us in our best moments, and on its own impetus, it affects the results. It is enough if we don't obstruct it, but it is unpardonable to allow, to call in the force, and when the force works, the divine Shakti works, to appropriate the workings for the ego, for the ego to want the higher force to work in a particular way, according to its dictates, according to its lines of action, so that it could aggrandize its own interests. And there comes in the role of purification. Unless one arrives at a minimum standard of purification, it is dangerous to invoke the higher power to work in us And the first step in this mental, in this purification, is the withdrawal of the mental purusha, the mental person, from activity. There is an immediate sense of liberation when one disentangles oneself from the innumerable rounds of the working force. It is not enough to withdraw, to stand back. Sri Aurobindo says that we have to use our will. After detachment, we have to use our will to raise ourselves into our higher spiritual status. That is, the dynamic part in us must not be left high and dry, but it should be uplifted into the higher spiritual state. That is, a transition has to be effected from the witness state to the state of status of mastery. And it is only when we are conscious that we are in the presence of the master of our being, the master of works, the master of sacrifice, that a movement of true surrender forms itself and effectuates itself. Once that happens, once one culminates in the movement of utter surrender, and the master takes charge of our being directly or through his Shakti, the battle is won. Not necessarily. There is a union, there is an identification with the Self, with the Lord. He may or may not move you into action. There is an identification with His Shakti, where mostly you are moved into activity. That is what he says next. There is an identity on the Purusha side of the Divine. There is an identity on the nature side. It is given to the individual to choose which he would have first. If it is to the Purusha, the stress is more on the witness, on the transcendental aspect. If it is the nature side, naturally the higher nature side, it is in movement, it is in action. And it is in the scheme of the divine manifestation that both the Purusha and Prakriti, that is nature, they recognize each other. They fuse into each other. They confess themselves to each other in the individual. In the individual, the jiva is the meeting place, so to say, of the Purusha and the Shakti. The first tendency of the mental Purusha when he withdraws from action or keeps only action on the surface and takes his poise in a silence is a certain passivity. But it is possible, instead of living in that passivity, one can impart a more kinetic nature to one's life. There is what Sri Aurobindo calls a kinetic yoga, and this kinetic yoga, and yoga that proceeds through action, from imperfect to less imperfect, and the beginnings of perfect, and then more and more perfect action. That is the kinetic yoga. It starts with subordinating oneself to the power. I am the doer, no doubt. Immediately I can't get that consciousness that I am not the doer. Mentally I may know, but the whole being and everything feels that I am the doer. Very well. One can start with the recognition that I am the subordinate doer. The Shakti, the higher power works. It works through me. But I do things. If I don't do, what can the Shakti do? That's the position taken up by those people who look from this angle. And it is easy for the mind, an enlightened mind or a seeking mind, to accept the position of being a subordinate doer. As this sense of subordination deepens and one grows in the divine quality of humility, humbleness, one comes to recognize in time that one is only a servant from the doer. The sense changes into being a servant of the Shakti. That too is a step, not the final step. Once this humility has come of myself being a servant of God, servant of the Shakti, it is the next step is that all is done by the Shakti. It does not need me. Even as a servant, I am just a point through which the universal Shakti individualizes itself and goes on to effect what it wants. So all is done by the Shakti. That too is a stage. If we are content to stay at this level of accepting the Shakti as supreme and the final truth, as there are certain traditions in India, that is a way, but that is a halfway. One has to become conscious of what is behind this Shakti, that is the Self. Behind the Shakti, there is the Shakta. Behind the Devi, there is the Deva. And in each individual, behind the motive force, behind the energy, there is someone who wields that power, who wields that energy through the will. And that is the Ishwar. That is the Lord. It is His will that is being effectuated by His power. The Shakti as such does not have an independent reality apart from the Divine Master. It is His will that is being worked out by the Divine Shakti. And the individual comes to realize that he is only, just as there he realized himself only first as a servant and then as a point through which the Shakti flows, here he realizes himself to be a small portion, a particle, an infinitesimal part, though a significant and a meaningful part of the Divine Being, the Divine Ruler, the Ishwar. The next step, Sri Aurobindo just indicates the possibility, is after one realizes oneself to be a part small or big, of the divine, the next is the next realization that opens its vistas is the one of avatar, that is, one is so much completely identified and merged in the divine being that one becomes the divine itself. There is no difference left. Whatever they may say in theory, in practice, one does not feel any distinction between oneself and the divine, the Ishvara. That is, the divine being, the divine consciousness is wholly there. Nothing separate of myself is left anywhere. I am one with it, and I am it.
What is the difference between avatar and vibhuti?
Yes. A vibhuti is a phenomenon when a divine quality or a divine power acts through an individual. It is something superhuman, preeminently divine power, beyond the normal range of human faculties. For purposes of evolution, the divine puts out such emanations of its power, of its knowledge, of its various verities, and either these emanations take human birth, do their work and withdraw, or they manifest in certain extraordinarily developed evolving beings and do their work. So a vibhuti is a case when a divine power, divine quality manifests on earth. There need not be a divine consciousness accompanying it. One may feel it is my own power. Napoleon always felt it is his own power. Shivaji did not go to that extent. But there are other vibhutis who always felt it was their great Shakespeare, for instance. These vibhutis, they are not conscious of the divine origin of the power they wield. But an avatar is not that. An avatar is a descent of the divine consciousness along with all the powers implicit in that consciousness on earth in a form, usually a human form, as Mother points out. And that form is conscious always, whether he expresses or not, that he is divine. The divine nature of the consciousness is always there. These avatars come once in a way at crucial junctures in the progress of human evolution. But vibhutis come comparatively frequently, take birth and effectuate the divine will in different spheres of activity, maybe in politics, maybe in literature, maybe in science, maybe in military field, and so on. All fields are proper fields for the divine work. And these radiations of the divine powers are called vibhutis. Sri Aurobindo points out in his elaborate discussion in the essays on the Gita on the subject that an avatar can be a vibhuti. An avatar need not have only a divine consciousness, but he may have certain powers in a striking manner. So to that extent, he has the vibhuti aspect also. But a vibhuti is never an avatar. Vibhuti is a secondary derivation, a limited formation for a limited purpose. A number of vibhutis prepare the field, prepare for the advent of an avatar. You must have heard of the parable of 10 avatars in the Indian tradition. No. How can it be a story? If evolution is not a story, if evolution is a fact, and it has passed through so many stages, at each level of transition, the divine has to embody itself in that form to link at a physical level the transition.
But now it cannot be anymore an animal, but it must be something
like Yes. Because that stage is over. There is a stage when a new form has to appear. So the avatar usually takes that new form, either ready or in the making. And the work of the avatar during his life period is to prepare for the establishment of that form, the corresponding consciousness and power in that form. Mother said to me once on this question that there is a universal healing power in the cosmos. Its function is to heal, make whole. You see, obviously, it derives from the plane of ananda, delight. But each one expresses it according to his level. There are those who give it a totally physical form by doing those passes and that kind of thing. There are those who can direct that healing force through the mind, through simple vibrations. Naturally, the level at which you receive and put out that healing power of God makes a difference. No, you can say, after all, the healing power is a part of the functioning of the universal Shakti. The universal Shakti has its aspect of knowledge, aspect of power, aspect of delight, and delight can't come where there is fragmentation, where there is limitation, where there is a lacune. So the role of delight, or what flows from the delight, is to make whole. If we choose, if we are content to shut ourselves in one realization, we are allowed to do that. The soul is always given a freedom by the divine to choose its direction of evolution, to choose its goal also. Why not? One can choose first this and first that, next that. They can go simultaneously, but one of them has to happen first, isn't it? It depends upon our line of evolution, whether we are more Purusha oriented or nature oriented, whether we are more active and dynamic by nature or tending to be, you know, passive and silent. But each one can prepare the field for the other.
Speaking about the personal aspect of God, is this something created by each individual himself, or is it a kind of common consent that one then realizes?
No, it has been there long before man came on earth. It is an integral part of the divine manifestation. That he is both, the divine is both a being and a state. Before the universe came into being, once the decision to manifest was taken, then both these things have come. The aspect of the Purusha and the aspect of the Shakti.
There are many realizations of the divine because they were part of the
total.
Does that account for the lineages of gurus that each of them has from time immemorial carried to a different
tradition? Yes, it exists because it is not simply a succession. In spiritual matters or in mystical things, when they speak of lineage, it does not mean that one man goes and another man comes and occupies the chair. It does not. When a tradition or a path or a yoga or a teaching starts, there is a divine impulsion. There is a divine consciousness fathering that movement. First it works through the person chosen. So the next person who occupies, he is not merely a person who has a spiritual realization on his own account, but he carries this charge of divine consciousness which the first person carried. So that is why we see that even when the persons occupying that pitha or the throne or the seat are third-rate people, when they do something it has a different effect. Among the other disciples there may be more gifted people, more developed people, but they can't deliver the goods in the manner in which the person seated on the place, you know, that incumbent can do. It is because of that thing, consciousness, charge of consciousness, which is transmitted from person to person. Of course, in course of time things fall into disuse and that consciousness also dissipates. So afterwards things remain just figurates. But the truth behind the parampara or the lineage, the tradition, is this.
The transfer, the theory that is so, vogue about the thousand.
Yeah. Same with the Pope also. See, once he occupies that seat, he is a different person. He must be feeling different.
But the theory is different.
No, it is a fact, not a theory. But human mind exaggerates things, provided you are completely one with that source. Certainly the infallibility is there, if you are one. But we know, usually the Pope or whoever it is, even if he is sincere, he may be sharing that only in the most developed part of his being. Yes. When he functions from that level only, he can be as infallible as the source of inspiration.
sense, I think the study of Mahansha some time ago, when purity was described as vastitude, and vast purity was shown to be united, I wonder why that's not mentioned more often. If that is the truth, and it feels like it is the truth, that purity is the vast. That's one question. The question allied to that is it so that one can aspire towards purity by aspiring towards vastitude?
Yes, in the Upanishads, there are passages which call for vastness to acquire purity. But there are also other passages in other Upanishads which speak of purity in terms of height, heights of consciousness, or depths of consciousness. The point is, there are certain movements which release you from the hold of impure nature. Now, nature being practically ubiquitous, we have to tackle the problem from different points. So, to extend oneself is a way of releasing yourself from the hold of ego, getting out of the taint of ego. But there is still the hold of inconscience, still the hold of nations, ignorance. So they have to exceed the lower nature. Then there is also the purity or the consciousness, the divinity that can be evoked from within. One goes not downward, but within, and from there brings out the psychic or the soul light or the soul power which dissipates the impurities. So for a seeker, all the three are necessary: to go deep, to go wide, to go high. Each one has its time and role.